Ania Lumba, the author of this essay, of the essay Feminism, Nationalism and Postcolonialism, is an Indian literary scholar. She is the author of Colonialism, Postcolonialism and works as a literature professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Her areas of research includes modern culture, postcolonialism, history of colonialism, etc. Since you have already read the essay, you might have understood and gone through the materials that were circulated earlier. You might have understood that the first, most of the pages of the essay deal with the concept of feminism, nationalism and nationalism and postcolonialism. It looks at the plight of women during the time of nationalism and the postcolonial period. How is there any change that happened in the lives of the women, especially during this period, is what the author looks into. While exploring this particular topic, the author also brings into our attention the cultural narratives that connect the mother's body and motherhood to the ideas of community, region and nation, both to establish the concept of the nation and to challenge it as an imagined community. The essay brings to our response the following questions. First, in what ways has the representation of the mother as national allegory constricted women's social, sexual, economic and political roles in different geographical, cultural and historic contexts? This is the first question that might arise in our minds after reading this particular essay. The second question is, how does mother as a nation disguise the ideology of motherhood, both in forcing women to want to be mothers and in keeping mothers in the private place rather than allowing them a public voice. The third question is, when and for what causes are women allowed to enter the public discourse and political activism as mothers, and when they have crossed the line, what will happen? The last question is, how do we recuperate the diverse individual and collective experiences of motherhood as well as of non-motherhood and integrate them into the historical narrative? Feminist and gender studies show how the family has served as a foundational metaphor for constructing national identities and national unity, as well as defining and legitimizing specific roles within the family and the nation. In the colonial period, the concept of Mother India had emerged as a powerful symbol in the nationalistic politics. However, this female cultural representation of Mother Nation undoubtedly had a socio-cultural and religious origin in the form of the earthly mother, the mother goddess and the motherland, and Bharat Mata, all of which shows the powerful mother goddess Durga or Kali as an important figure in the Hindu pantheon, at once nurturing and destructive. So the images of Kali and Durga and the Bharat Mata concept, which were very popular during those particular times, have a link with the Hindu religion. Hindu nationalism, in the militant discourse of Hindu nationalism, this religious symbolism reigned supreme, and Mother India came to represent the holy land upon which Ram Raj was to be constructed or founded. Communalist ideologues felt that her virtue and purity must be aggressively defended against alien men, whether Muslim or the British. This might be the reason why nation itself was given a feminine gender, so that whenever there is an attack on the nation, it will be protected by the fellow men. The concept of Mother India was aptly
framed so as to exploit both the imperialist and the nationalist investments in the woman question for making its own case against Indian self-government. It owed its entire discussion of the plight of Indian women, in fact, to the central tropes that had already been long established in the imperialist writings on women in India. Mother India, for example, defined the problems of women in India only in relation to the timeless Hindu cultural practices. There is a reference to the abolition of sati in the coming up pages and why it was considered important in the Indian history. You can go through the pages and find the anecdote there. Its diagnosis of the problems of Indian women ignored both the historical and the material factors that were behind particular cultural practices and the shifting impact of these practices on women. By overlooking the role of colonial state in its diagnosis of women's condition in India, moreover, it also looks at the colonial interventions in Indian economy and in Indian culture. Mother India paid attention only to the contributions of British men and women in the upliftment of Indian women. Neither the colonial government's repeated opposition to a number of reform measures, including bills sponsored by Indian legislators for raising the age of consent and abolishing child marriage, nor the many reform initiatives for women undertaken by Indian men and women themselves, held much interest. Before we go deep into the topic of feminism and nationalism, as the title clearly says about nationalism, I would like to talk a little bit more about nationalism. You might be familiar with the term nationalism, but what do you think is the definition? Can you give a definition of nationalism? Nationalism is an idea which fills man's brain and heart with new thoughts and new sentiments and drives him to translate his consciousness into deeds of organized action. Nationality is not merely about organization and forming a homogeneous identity, but more importantly, it is a group seeking to find its expression in what it regards as the highest form of organized activity, a sovereign state. Like all complex historical movements, nationalism is not a monolithic phenomenon to be deemed entirely good or entirely bad. Nationalism has its own pros and cons. The theory of nationalism has always been complicated by this background and by the intrusion of nationalist ideology into the theory. There are also national differences in the theory of nationalism, that is, depending upon the local history, there are changes in the definitions of nationalism. By the end of the 19th century, there was a grappling issue of getting freedom from the colonial power. This process was accompanied by a process of self-definition where nation-states that emerged out of anti-colonial struggles debated and constructed a discourse not just around a set of democratic rights but also around a notion of selfhood and identity. One needs to look at the specific socio-historical conditions in which most of these nationalist movements occur and try to understand these movements as rational attempts made under difficult conditions to pursue the universally accepted ideals of enlightenment and progress. Partha Chatterjee is a name which you all know. You are familiar with the theories, the essays written by Partha Chatterjee. In his overview of the discourse of nation and nationalism, he discusses the process of modernization that began in Europe because of enlightenment. So he thinks that not only the history shows that modernization had its beginning in Europe and it gradually spread to the rest of the world, affecting the traditional setup of many non-European societies.
In his view, the problem with nationalism is that it attains and continues the baleful legacies of Eurocentrism and Orientalism. So, he thinks that as most of the theories, nationalism also tend to be a little bit Eurocentric. Critics have generally argued that the concept of nation was invented or imagined into existence in the 19th century, even though in the Indian context it has to be noted that Bharata Varsha or Hindustan has thousands of years of historical tradition. Colonial India is merely a fragment of this long tradition, and a study of the colonial India is insufficient to come to any conclusion regarding the beginnings of nationalism in India. Benedict Anderson, the theories of his imagined community we already discussed. His own print capitalism and determination of nationalism through language fixes a Western pattern of one language, one nation that cannot be an acceptable model for a country like India, which has diverse languages and cultural traditions. You might be familiar with the name Virginia Woolf, who talked about women's need to have rooms of their own or a space of their own. In her Three Guineas, she talks about the connection between woman and a country. The quotation goes like this: as a woman, I have no country. As a woman, I want no country. It is a thought that she expresses. It is difficult to decipher whether Woolf's elated disenfranchisement of herself springs from the defiance or defeat. However, it raises an important question: where is the woman in the project of nationalism and the nation state? Does she have a role? If at all she has a role, what is the role that she plays in it? So, if you have gone through the essay, the first page of the essay, you might have now understood that since nation and women are equated and the concept of nation and family are equated, nationalistic spirit or and the colonial powers have tried to equate all these in such a way that women, the so-called the women of this period, does not have a say of their own. They are just equated to all these concepts. They don't have a say of their own, but they are elevated in the paper, just the paper. So it means that the motherland, which the essays or the theories talk about, the mother India or the Brito Mart, which the theories talk about, is a male nationalistic spirit, is a male nationalistic concept, and it might not signify home to a lot of women they are talking about. Unlike men, women appear in a metaphoric or symbolic role in all these cases. From the starting itself, feminist analysis or analysis of politics, nation, citizenship, etc. shows that women are excluded from the exercise of political power. For long periods of history, women were denied the vote even in the Western democracies. And women are still dramatically underrepresented in the formal political institutions and the decision-making bodies worldwide. The Renaissance spirit did not guarantee women liberty or equality, though the theory and the historical representations tend to portray it in that way. It has not actually liberated the women. Writings on education, domestic life and society have been identified, which sharply distinguishes an inferior domestic realm from the superior public realm of men. So there is a difference between, there are two realms that are created by the Renaissance, during that particular Renaissance period, that is the inferior domestic realm and the superior public realm of men. This itself is the private and the public sphere which Habermas talks about. I think we'll discuss in detail the further concepts in the next classes. This is the lecture for today. I hope you understood what have that what has been discussed already.
In the previous class, I had given an article about how colonial rule and family as a public space has been important during those times. And coming to the page, page number 182, which we have to discuss today, it talks about, as I already said, family as a resistance, as a point of, as a place of resistance, and also about women's education. So considering like when we look at the condition of women during the colonial times, we get an image of Indian women. The image we get of Indian women is that of passivity, of a group silenced doubly. How are they silenced doubly? First, in the nationalist discourses. Second, in the more recent post-colonial scheme of things. So, we see women as a silent shadow, veiled and mute before her oppressors. Here, the oppressors are might be the colonizers and also the colonized. That is, her own native, her own relatives or her own cohabitants, who are actually oppressing her. As has been pointed out earlier, for the colonial state, this was a part of a strategy to perpetuate their domination. So, unlike all those claims that colonial rule was a boon to the women, it's totally opposite. This is what the author says in this particular essay. The author says that the condition of women remained almost the same, whether she was educated or not. It was almost the same both during the colonial times and during the post-colonial times. For the the women were helpless, and but they were in need of protection from the colonial rule and from her own native people. In the later historical writings, authors have showed how the Indian women became the site for nationalist constructions of tradition and cultural authenticity in the quest for self-identity from the late 19th century onwards. Faced with defeat and humiliation in the political and material world, Indian men constructed the women as the repositories of all that was pure and worthy in their own culture. So the women became the symbol of all the of the pure culture of their own motherland. In both perspectives, women emerge as unresisting, inert and passive objects of defining discourses, as people without any control over their lives. On the other hand, where women are discovered in assertive roles, they are either participants in larger mass struggles under the tutelage of the male peers and guardians. It is to be noted that race, caste, class and gender are mutually determining forces and cooperate and operative on one another. They depend on one another. Sometimes they act in coalition with each other. They act together. So, the inequalities of power that the women face in the Indian situation, in the Indian India, actually depend on these three axes: class, race, and gender. Another thing that the author has not mentioned here is caste. Indeed, the intersection of caste and gender in India is a powerful predictor of women's place, knowledge, voice, work, role and relations. So, it is very crucial in the history of colonial and post-colonial India. The role of caste is very important. A core site of gender inequality which mirrors itself
in various legal and kinship arrangements, and indeed in every zone of life, is the area covered by the broad term family. Here, the earliest socializations are engineered. The first division of labor designed and notions of masculinity and femininity are framed at the outset. An individual's birth, education, marriage, work, and death are intricately connected with it.
So in this particular essay, towards the beginning of the page, it says that in many situations, especially that of slavery, colonialism violently intruded upon, broke up and appropriated families of colonized subjects. ഇവിടെ നമ്മൾ ശ്രദ്ധിക്കേണ്ട ഒരു കാര്യം എന്ന് വെച്ചാൽ, നിങ്ങൾ കൊളോണിയലിസം ഇന്ത്യയിലെ കാര്യം മാത്രമല്ല, യു ഹാവ് ടു തിങ്ക് അബൌട്ട് ദ കൊളോണിയലിസം ഇൻ ജനറൽ, ഹൗ ഇറ്റ് ബ്രോക്ക് അപ്പ് ദ ഫാമിലി സ്ട്രക്ചർ അസ് സച്ച്, എങ്ങനെയാണത് ബ്രേക്ക് ചെയ്തതെന്നുള്ള ഓർക്കണം. എസ്പെഷ്യലി ഇത് ഓർക്കാനുള്ള ഒരു മെയിൻ ഇമ്പോർട്ടൻ്റ് ആയിട്ടുള്ള ഒരു കാര്യം എന്ന് വെച്ചാൽ, ഇതിൽ നമ്മുടെ ആഫ്രിക്കൻ കൺട്രീസിൽ ഹൗ ദ സ്ലേവ് സിസ്റ്റം വാസ് മെയിൻറ്റെയിൻഡ്, ഹൗ children were took away from the families, and how the family structure, they never knew, the children never knew who their father was, they had such a family structure. So slavery system vannapoḷtheka it actually broke up the entire family system nanu idile parnirikkunnathu. And as per the author's comment, these type of activities appropriated the families of the colonized subjects. And in the essay, it also says that some of these types of intrusions were imagined and feared. ഇങ്ങനെയുള്ള കാര്യങ്ങൾ സംഭവിക്കുമെന്ന് പേടിച്ചിരുന്നിട്ട് പോലും റെസിസ്റ്റൻസുകൾ ഉണ്ടായിട്ടുണ്ട് ഈ ഫാമിലീസിൽ നിന്ന്. So in the time of colonialism, gender relations as well as the patterns of sexuality come to symbolize both such a cultural essence, both the cultural essence and the cultural differences. So it means that these type of gender relationships that existed during the colonial times showcased the differences as well as the essence of the cultural beliefs of these particular period. Ania Lumba also talks about certain cultural practices that were considered as untranslatable. Some of it were veiling, polygamy, widow immolation, matrilineal same sex relationships. All these types of acts were considered to be culturally untranslatable. So Ania Lumba believes that even the maintaining or the practicing of these types of activities, these types of cultural practices, or a resistance to these types of practices are very important, are very key, are key to the central to the colonial struggles of that particular period. So in the towards the beginning of this essay, we had already discussed about nation as a mother, how the concept was very important during those period. Again, there is a repetition here where the author talks about the image of nation or the culture as a mother worked to evoke both the female power and the female helplessness. The nation as mother protected her son from colonial ravages, but was also herself ravaged by the colonialism and in need of her son's protection. You might have clearly understood this if you remember all those lectures in the initial classes. It just talks about the helplessness and the power, both the helplessness and the power of the female during the time of colonialism. And here there is a quote by Sri Aurobindo. He says that my country as mother, I offer her my devotions, my worship. If a monster sits upon her breast and prepares to suck her blood, what does her child do? Does he quietly sit down to his meal or rush to her rescue? And this is quoted by Ashish Nandi. It talks about how the image of mother and the purity are connected. If culture, the concept of culture is also connected to the mother,
how her own children came to protect her when she was in trouble. Here again, in the next paragraph also there is a repetition. It talks about the limited agency that really, that in the real life women got. Though papers and the beliefs and all those cultural practices talked about powerful women, real women had limited agency. Then it talks about women's education during the colonial times. Educated women have to be taught not to overstep the bounds and usurp authority from men. So you might have already read articles about how the education system of women was there in the colonial. Sorry for the disturbances. There are a lot of disturbances here where I sit. That's why there are lots of noises coming in, and I am getting disturbed in between while I'm recording this. So I was talking about how the education system in England was. It was a preparatory stage for a better family life. Women were taught only to be to behave themselves. They were wanted to be ladylike. That was the education they were given. They were taught not to control over the male partners. So here in the text it says that humanist arguments in favor of women's education were careful to distinguish between a learned woman and a virago who might usurp male authority. So here we have to note the fact that a learned woman will never usurp the male authority, while an totally uneducated woman can do the same. And humanist writings constructed women in a particular way that they were companions and helpmates to the men. So in this particular page we get to know that the women's movement never bore a consistent relationship to the freedom movement and was experiencing change with change in the discourses characterizing the freedom struggle. Women's question got expression first in the form of reforms demanded by men folk to bring an end to the pathetic condition of women towards the late 19th century, and ultimately subsuming itself into the dominant discourse of national freedom, prioritizing national identity to women's identity. So here's a quote by a theoretician about the plight of women during the colonial times. The theoretician's name is Padma Anagol. The quote goes like this: "The position of women in Indian society has been looked at either as part of broader studies in the social and cultural history of India, or more directly in the attempt to trace the changing role of women in colonial India. Such scholars have argued that improvements in the status of women came about from the 19th century onwards, not as the product of a process of conscious assertion or on the part of the Indian women, but through the programs of social reform devised and carried out by Indian men and the colonial state. In many ways, the image which emerges of Indian women as passive recipients in these processes has been predetermined by the approaches which scholars have adopted. In the Western impact, Indian response paradigm that informs the work, there is little room for women as conscious agents. Instead, Indian women are projected as a monolithic and oppressed entity and reduced to mere beneficiaries of the awakening."
Good morning. In the last class, we talked about women's education, how it has been in the colonial times. We just briefed, we just had a few points about it. The detailed points will be dealt with in the page number 183 of the essay. So it goes like this. In page number 183, it says that in the colonial context, the debates on women's education echoed these earlier histories, but of course they were further complicated by racial and colonial hierarchies. The question of female education itself became a colonial battlefield. The last quarter of the 19th century in India saw the growing influence of modern education under the influence of British. As a result, a section of the Indian society evolved that was educated in this modern Western system and was influenced by the ideas of equality, justice, freedom, and rational thought. Women's education became a very important topic in the context of British rule, because it was part of the civilizing mission. Since the plight of women was really bad during those times, the British took it as their duty to impart certain amount of knowledge to the women. Education of women became the central focus of the reform movements in India by the British people. To understand the reform movements in India during the 19th century, especially in the field of education, we have to remember two models, the retroactive model and the proactive model of education. The first one is the proactive reform model. The most dominant historiography of the 19th century reform movements related to women has been that it attempted to bring improvements in the women's lives, bringing them opportunities of education and greater participation in public life, freeing them from the traditional ritual lifestyle of the pre-modern era. So this particular model, reform model, proactive reform model, considers reform movement as a constructive phenomenon that has a major role in the upliftment of the condition of women during the 19th century. The main focus of this area of the proactive reform discourse is that it discusses the efforts to introduce Indian women to the world outside their domestic spaces. Women were educated and familiarized in Western discourse either at home or in school. A major stress of this education was on learning English language, especially when the women studied in schools. The retroactive reform model, the second model, during the last decades of the 20th century and in the beginning of the 21st century, there has developed a critique of the proactive form of historiography. This is actually called the retroactive reform movement. According to this particular model, it says that the education given by the British people did not encourage the women to emerge as independent individual identities. Thus, this critique underlines this reform movement as not really a feminist movement that could liberate the women from the traditional structures. The main reasons that the retroactive reform model puts forward are the strategy to maintain the family in the modern world, the reaction against the imperialist Eurocentric criticism of India, and the continuation of masculine dominance. A prominent argument of the critical discourse on 19th century women's educational reforms has been that the efforts made by the reformers were not aimed at the uplifting of women's conditions. Rather, they wanted to resolve the problem of continuing the family system against the changes and critiques brought by the India's encounter with Europe in the 19th century. This discourse argues that women were expected to become educated and modernized because it was thought that these women would be able to perform the obligations of the child rearing and homemaking really well. Thus, the personal advancement of women was not the focus of this particular movement. It is worth noting that this thought process has survived to this day in many parts of India, especially in the context of women's education. The second point that I mentioned earlier was the reaction against the imperialist Eurocentric criticism of India. In the 19th century, many Europeans saw Indian society as backward and ignorant, Hence, they felt that it was the responsibility of the European rulers to civilize the Indian society, the great civilizing mission. They felt that the integral part of the civilization process was to teach them the ideas of rationalism and modernity. You have to remember these two concepts, rationalism and modernity. This Eurocentric argument provided legitimacy to the colonial rule by presenting the Europeans as superior to the Indians. So there is a hierarchy that is being taught through this education also. Hence, this Eurocentric discourse served to maintain British imperialism in India. English education was part of this modernization process. According to this model of reform, the reform movements were made as a response to the imperialistic critic from Europe and not as a conscious attempt to reform the women and to liberate them. The third point that I mentioned earlier was the continuation of masculine dominance. The retroactive reform model of education argues that whenever reforms related to women were made in the 19th century, they were in fact defined by men, not by the women themselves. I have already discussed this point in the last class, where I talked about how the reform movements were initiatives of men in India. Hence, according to the historiographic model, these reforms again reflected the changed aspirations and the notions of femininity of the educated men, not of the women. The women were expected to follow the fresh normative standards set by the men, rather than evolving their own standards according to their own perceptions and aspirations. So, here we come to know that the women did not have a choice of their own. They were just being used by the men, even in terms of reforms. So in our essay also, the author Anya Lumba talks about how the reform movements were implemented by the British people. When the British people tried to implement an education system in India, there was also a counter education system which was promoted by the Indians. But none of these education systems helped the women of the times. So, this is what Anya Lumba thinks about this women's education. If colonialists claim to reform women's status by offering them education, nationalists countered by charting a parallel process of education and reform, one which would simultaneously improve the women's lot and protect them from becoming decultured. In the 19th century, Bengali discourses, for instance, the over-educated woman is represented as becoming a Mem Sahib or English woman who neglects her home and her husband. So here, the view about women's education is that too much education and like too little results in bad domestic practices. And this is actually quoted by Partha Chatterjee. And the quote goes like this: if you have acquired real knowledge, then give no place in your heart to Mem Sahib like behavior. That is not becoming in a Bengali housewife. See how an educated woman can do housework thoughtfully and systematically in a way unknown to an ignorant, uneducated woman. And see if God has not appointed us to this place in the home, how unhappy a place this world would be. This is Partha Chatterjee's quote. So here we have to note the point how what education was supposed to do. An educated woman can do her housework thoughtfully and systematically when in comparison with an uneducated woman. In the next paragraph, there is this word Bhadra Mahila, or the gentle woman. I was just reminded of the concept of Griha Lakshmi, and many of the writers of the times have mentioned this concept in the literature. Tagore, the famous writer, is one among the writers who has mentioned a lot about Grihalakshmi. The Grihalakshmi or the housewife imagined in the divine model of Lakshmi, the goddess of domestic well-being, became yet another site of nationalistic aestheticization. In a booklet which was published in 1877, I saw this in the net, it was said that an uneducated woman cannot be skilled in Griha Karya. This is exactly what Partha Chatterjee quotes in the essay. So, education became the tool to perform the Griha Karya well. It does not have any other function according to the concepts which were believed by the men of those period. And a woman who neglects Griha Karya for the sake of education will find her learning to be useless. So it's a double-edged sword. If you have to get education for performing the Griha Karyas properly, and if you are leaving your Griha Karya for the sake of education, you won't be able to make use of the skills that you learn through education. So here in the essay, ideal woman according to the old concept is that it shows the female self-sacrifice and devotion, and it is very much similar to the Victorian enlightened mother. Okay, I think we stopped in page number 183. We finished page number 183, and we are about to start page number 184, for which I had some reading materials given earlier. And in page number 183, remember, it is about the Bhadra Mahila or the gentlewoman who should be ladylike and at the same time educated. So, what was the idea given about a highly educated woman in those particular times? Is that she was called a Mem Sahib if she was over educated. This was what we discussed in the last classes, and in page number 184 it talks about how patriarchy was strengthened so that the colonial power can be exhibited more, can be practiced in a more effective manner. And the Anialumba author says like this: if the strengthening of patriarchy within the family became one way for colonized men to assert the otherwise eroded power, women's writings often testify to the confusion and pain that accompanied these enormous changes. So, since there were enormous changes, enormous socio-political changes happening in the society, society during those particular times, in the form of reformation, women had to undergo or women had to face a lot of changes, and as a result of this there was utter confusion and pain which the women suffered. And here in the text the author talks about the autobiography of Ramabai Ranade, who was married at the age of 11 to a well-known scholar and jurist, Mahadev Govind Ranade. And Ramabai describes how she was torn, how she had to cope with the desire of her husband and with the decisions, the tradition and the decisions taken by the women of the family. How her husband wanted her to be educated, and how the women of the family wanted her to follow the traditional Kulstri type of image. And one day, while she pretended to be ill and preferred to stay at home, and what was the reaction that her husband showed is very annoying. He was actually worried about her decision, and this is what she says. The reaction occurs in this particular way. I started rubbing his feet with the ghee myself. I wanted him at least to say, now that's enough. But no, he went off to sleep as soon as I started rubbing his feet. Usually, after an hour's massage, he would extend his other foot and ask us to start working on that. But today, I don't know how he did not forget his resolve of silence. Even in his sleep, he didn't speak a single word. So, this shows the utter confusion and dilemma that the women of the times had to face. In the name of reformation, or in the name of empowering the women, they were educated, they were actually given education, but here what is to be noticed is that they didn't have a choice of their own. It was not according to their will whether they had to go to, they wanted to go to the school or to the temple. It was the decision, the sole decision of the male of the family that she had to follow. And at the same time, the older women of the family were highly traditional, and they wanted the younger bride or the younger women to follow the tradition. So there is this confusion always. And Aniya Lumba here says that Ramabai Ranade didn't even know what was the fault that she did during the situation. She had to apologize to her husband so that he speaks to her. So in page number 185, it says, the self-fashioning of the nationalist male thus required his fashioning of his wife into a fresh subservience, even though this new role included her education and freedom from some older orthodoxies. So when the times demanded the reformation or the self-fashioning of the male, they had to in turn refashion their own wives or their own daughters. Here it is only mentioned as wife. Their own daughters are also a matter of concern. And refashioning the female, the women of the family, they are actually freed from certain older orthodoxies and are given education. And in this attempt to reform the women of the times, of the society of the times, there is this disappearance of women from the discourses. Even though they are supposed to be reformed, or they are the subjects to be reformed, they almost disappear from the discussions. From the colonial as well as the nationalist record, we learn little about how they felt or responded, and until recently, there is no response about the emotions of the women who were succumbed to this reformation. So, it means that there is no voice heard from the part of the women who are being reformed. And here there is an example by Ladamani, who suggests that the entire colonial debate on sati, she actually discusses about sati, how it was about a redefining of tradition and modernity and less about women being the sati. So it did not give priority to the loss of life of a woman. Rather, it gave priority to the redefining of tradition. This is just one example cited here. Another might be the case of the widows. Widows were a matter of concern during those times, and their own inferiority and the pain they faced were little discussed. There were actions taken by the by the reformers to reform, to uplift the position of the women or of the widows, but little was said about the emotions and the pain that the widows face. And here Aniya Lumba cites Gayatri Chakravarti Spivak's oft-quoted essay, Can the Subaltern Speak, You might have had this in like some of the heard this in some of the seminars or in any of the texts you have already learned. It's a very famous essay, "Can the Subaltern Speak?" So here she says that there is this absence of the women's voices even when they are even when there is the immolation debates or the reformation debates go strong, and this she considers is an apt emblem of the intermixed violence of colonialism and patriarchy. So here she means that this is the result, the absence of the voices of the women is the result of patriarchy and colonialism. So throughout the essay by Anya Lumba, she says that women, though even in the time of colonialism and in the time of post-colonial colonialism, are being subjected, and what are the ways and means through which they are subjected is being discussed here. And there is this another word in the next paragraph, site, S-I-T-E, women being the sites of reformation rather than the subjects of reformation. And she says that though women, these acts of reformation are hot topics of debates in the post-colonial studies, the women are not given priority here. So in the next lines in the essay, it says that women are being marginalized even in discourses about them. Leave alone all the other discourses that happen in the society, even in the case of reforming them, they are being marginalized. How are they being marginalized here? By not letting them speak. This is exactly what Spivak says in her essay, "Can the Subaltern Speak?" Can the subjugated women, can the subjugated people speak for themselves? Rather than being spoken about, can they actually talk about themselves, talk about their emotions? This is actually the above lecture I have given is actually the main points of page number 183 and 184 and 185. The rest of it we'll discuss in the next class. Thank you.
Okay, in the last class we dealt with page number 185. Today we have to deal with page number 186 and 187. ലാസ്റ്റ് ക്ലാസ്സിൽ നമ്മൾ പറഞ്ഞുകൊണ്ടിരുന്നത് റിഫോം മൂവ്മെൻറ്റ്സിനെ പറ്റിയായിരുന്നു. അവിടെ എങ്ങനെയൊക്കെയാണ് വിമൻസ് റിഫോർമേഷൻ എങ്ങനെയൊക്കെയാണ് അവരെ അഫക്റ്റ് ചെയ്തത് എന്ന് പറഞ്ഞു. സോ ടുഡേയ്സ് ക്ലാസ് ഇസ് ഓൾസോ എ കണ്ടിന്യൂവേഷൻ ഓഫ് ദാറ്റ് പേജ് നമ്പർ 186 അതൊക്കെ തന്നെയാണ് പറയുന്നത്. 186 പറയുന്നത് റിഫോർമേഷൻ റിഫോംസ് അല്ലെങ്കിൽ റിഫോർമേഷൻ മൂവ്മെൻറ്റ്സ് നടന്നിട്ടുണ്ടെങ്കിൽ പോലും ദേ വർ ക്വയറ്റ് ഷുവർ ദാറ്റ് വിമൻ ഷുഡ് ബി കെപ്റ്റ് ഇൻ ദെയർ ഓൺ പ്ലേസ്. അതാണ് പേജ് നമ്പർ 186 ബിഗിനിങ്ങിൽ പറഞ്ഞിരിക്കുന്നത്. ദസ് ഡെസ്പൈറ്റ് ദർ അതർ ഡിഫറൻസസ് ആൻഡ് ഡെസ്പൈറ്റ് ദ കോണ്ടസ്റ്റ് ഓവർ നേറ്റീവ് വിമൻ, കൊളോണിയൽ ആൻഡ് ഇൻഡിജിനസ് പേട്രിയാർക്കീസ് ഓഫൺ കൊളാബറേറ്റഡ് ടു കീപ് വിമൻ ഇൻ ദെയർ പ്ലേസ്. അവരുടെ സ്ഥാനത്ത് അവരെ നിർത്തുന്നതിൽ ഈ രണ്ട് കൂട്ടരും ഒരേപോലെ ഉറച്ചു നിന്നു എന്നാണ് നമ്മൾ ഇവിടെ പറഞ്ഞിരിക്കുന്നത്. So it would be interesting to note in this connection Rousseau's Emily. You might have heard about Rousseau, and Rousseau's Emily is a famous work which talks about women's education. We had dealt with women's education in the previous pages, but there I forgot to talk about this. Here you just don't have to relate it just to education, but you can see it with a wider perspective. The quotation goes like this: thus women's entire education should be placed in relation to men, to please men, to be useful to them, to win over their love and respect, to raise them as children, care for them as adults. So this is the view that people had about education, and also education was meant to be a way of reformation. So if education was supposed to be to please men and to be useful, how to be a useful person to men, so there can't be much change happening in the condition of women. So, even in the minds of women in the concerned period, they were conditioned in such a manner that they had accepted the subordinate status within the patriarchal system without much resistance. And in keeping with the patriarchal norms, there was complete division in the duties, rights and responsibilities of a man and a woman within the family. So, the existence of this type of a differentiation and a division of labor was necessary to ensure peace and harmony within the family and the society. So, there is another review which I read in the read online about women's education, and it says like this: education is essential for both men and women, but education of a similar kind as that meant for a man cannot be useful for a woman in the same way, because the paths and duties are entirely different. So women should be educated not to enable them to seek a job, but to perform their domestic and social duties to the best of their abilities. To quote a famous political leader, Lokmanya Tilak, you all know about him. He was totally against the idea of imparting higher education to women, and he strongly criticized the curriculum of the female high school. To quote him, "Every middle class man wants his wife to be literate and well trained in household duties, to spend her leisure hours in reading religious texts in order to improve her mind and to help him in domestic duties. Just as a trade is of primary importance to a craftsman and training is secondary, so are household duties generally primary for women and education incidental. By the age of 15 or 16, a woman should be well trained in housework, and this training will never be available in a school as much as at home. The marital home is a workshop of female education." So this reinstates that in a male-dominated patriarchal Indian society, the type of education which was given to women re-emphasized their familial roles. As a daughter, she was supposed to be obedient to her father. As a wife, she was supposed to be dutiful to her husband. And in her old age, she was to be an appendage of her son. So, this will clearly explain what woman's place was in during those times. And this is exactly what page number 186 talks about. Both the colonial and the native reformers were very much worried about the position and the agency and the power women exercised. So there has been a representation of women in symbolic and real roles. And here in the text, the author says that symbolism has a very crucial role, because it shapes the real life roles women had to play. You might have heard about Charles Grant, who was a famous missionary, and he had written an influential tract in 1792, and it was titled "Observations on the State of Society Among the Asiatic Subjects of Great Britain." This tract explained the relationship between Britain and India. I'm quoting Charles Grant here because in our text there is a play towards the middle of page number 186. There is mention about Pandita Ramabai, who converted to Christianity. Here I'm referring to Charles Grant to connect with that. Charles Grant's observations about Indian society goes like this: "While men were bound by no moral restraints and lived with the insensibility of brutes, Indian women were doomed to a life of servitude and self-imprisonment, and a violent and premature death. Introduction of Christianity, according to Grant, would make the Indians rise in the scale of civilization." You might be aware of the religious conversions during those particular period, because Indians believe that religious conversions will help them to raised to the status of British people. So Charles Grant believed that Raj or British Raj should establish itself firmly in India by planting the language, knowledge, their opinions and also their language in the Asiatic territories. So in this particular way, they can establish themselves in India. And it may thus be seen that the portrayal of a negative picture of Indian culture was given, which was given in the textbooks, historical books, especially the of the evangelical missionaries. It was highly motivated. And there is no wonder that this view became widely accepted later, for it provided a justification for British rule in India. So we are leading to the to a connection where the great civilizing mission is about to begin. With this object in mind, British missionary women started coming to India during the latter part of the 19th century. So in the text, Ramabai converted to Christianity because she was fed up of the Orthodox beliefs. Both the Orthodox and the nationalist Hindus had about women. So she converted to Christianity, and this was considered as a betrayal of the Hindu ideologies. And again in the text, it talks about the Hindu home as the domain of Indian culture. I think we dealt with this towards the beginning of the essay, where family, we talked about family as the place where culture was rooted. So even when women and gender are seen as emblematic of culture and nation, they also signify breaks or fault lines within these categories. So they also showed whenever there is a break or whenever there is a fault. As usual, women who broke the rules of the society or the codes of silence were treated as hostile, were not treated in a good way. So here we come to understand that it's not different from the time now, from now. Like when women start speaking for themselves or start raising their voice, they are actually silenced. So they are actually treated as a threat to the society, a threat to the tradition. So in the text, it says that when the women are collected or potentially in a collective way, are treated as a threat to the society, and both by the colonial rulers and by the native reformers. We know that British had a policy of not interfering in the cultural beliefs of the Indian society. They promised to do that, but unfortunately or fortunately, they happened to execute certain laws which banned sadi, child marriage, and all those practices in the Indian culture. And we have to understand the fact that it's not just for the benefit of the Indian women or the Indian society as a whole. It has this motive of presenting Indian society in a negative way. So again, towards the end of page number 186, the author Tanya Lumba talks about how in Latin America also the situation was not much different. And I have shared the article on black consciousness, piece on black consciousness, where patriarchy, which was also a movement which concentrated on men and the participation of men in the nationalist movements. So in page number 187, Gandhi's non-cooperation movement has been termed as proto-feminist. So who is a proto-feminist? In layman's language, proto-feminist is a term used to define a person in a philosophical tradition which depicts modern feminist concepts at a time when the term feminist was unknown, which is prior to the 20th century. Gandhi believed that Indian women, who are constantly struggling with domestic and the national liberty, their strength lay in their weakness. After he returned to India, he appealed to the women to inculcate the non-violent strength against the brutal masculine power of British. This explains the sentence in the text about Gandhiji's proto-feminism. It goes like this. Others such as Gandhi's non-cooperation movement have been called as a proto-feminist not only because they mobilized enormous numbers of women but also because they adopted attributes such as passivity and activities such as spinning that are traditionally considered female. But one may question whether such attributes are really female, and recall that Gandhi's movement censored women's militancy and adhered to entirely patriarchal conceptions of the family and the society. This clearly explains how Gandhiji wanted women to participate in the national struggle, and this is exactly the belief most of the Indian men had during those times. Women have to participate in the nationalist movement, but within the limits of the society, or within the limits, or within the borders of the family. So the woman question during those times was so ticklish and complicated that the nationalists found it very much difficult to find an appropriate solution to it. In the words of a famous theorist, Shivanath Shastri, he says, he talks like this: women are fish bones in our throats. We cannot cuff them up, we dare not swallow them up. You all obviously know what a fish bone is and how the experience of having it in your throat is. And this is how he compares woman's question to. So a resolution to this anomaly was sought to be explained by representing women as the dynamic aspect of the divine, the authentic body of national tradition. This is what we referred to in the beginning of the essay, embodying the principle of continuity, and men as the progressive agents of national modernity, embodying the static aspect of the divine, the principle of discontinuity. Men are here treated as the agency of reformation. According to Partha Chatterjee, the reason why the issue of female emancipation had disappeared from the public agenda of the nationalist agitation in the late 19th century was not because it was overtaken by more emotive issues concerning the political power, but because of the refusal of nationalism to make the women's question an issue of political negotiation with the colonial state. They didn't want to involve this issue while negotiating for freedom from the colonial state. Problems related to women had to be solved within themselves, or it was considered as an internal matter which has to be solved without any kind of intervention from the British. In the words of Partha Chatterjee, in the entire phase of national struggle, the crucial need was to protect, preserve and strengthen the inner core of the national culture, its spiritual essence. No encroachments by the colonizer must be allowed in that inner sanctum. In the world, imitation of and adaptation to Western norms was necessity. At home, they were tantamount to annihilation of one's very identity. You might have understood what it means. This is the crux of the essay. Even though they wanted to get freedom from the colonizer, they never wanted any imitation or adaptation of Western norms when it comes to the culture inside the home. The quotations I have taken or the references I have made, most of them comes from Partha Chatterjee's piece of writing titled The Nationalist Resolution to the Women's Question. It comes in the book Recasting Women, which is edited by Kumkum Sanghari and Sudesh Vaid. And I think this is enough for today's class. You can go through page number 186 and 187 towards the midway of 187. And this is what happens in these pages. In page number 188, it just talks about how the newly liberated nations gave more rights to women when compared to the European counterparts. And there is also a suggestion that the relationship with the question of women's rights and that of anti-colonial movements was very complex and ambiguous, as we have seen throughout the essay. How the relationship went about, we have discussed already. There is this quotation by Mac Clintock in the text. It goes like this: while the language of the ANC was the inclusive language of national unity, the contrast was in fact exclusive and hierarchical, ranked by an upper house of chiefs, a lower house of elected representatives, all male, and an executive, always male. Indians and so-called coloureds were excluded from full membership. So the author thinks that this might be the reason why women's struggles for equality continued even after independence. She also thinks that anti-colonial national struggles or the these type of struggles did actually give a space for women by legitimizing the public activity, by legitimizing the public presence. And she thinks that the participation of women in politics is much more accepted in post-colonial countries than in the metropolitan ones because of this kind of struggles, because of the history of struggles they had earlier. There is another point that comes up in the last paragraph of this page. It is, not only does women's active participation in politics not necessarily indicate a feminist consciousness or agenda, but in recent years there has been an effort to harness women's political activity and even militancy to the right-wing movements, and especially to religious fundamentalism. So the point that comes here is the connection between women, feminism, and religion. And the author thinks that the connection between women, feminism, and religion is a very tricky one, because it has surfaced as a major factor in women's relationship to the nation and to the post-colonial politics, because most of the third world countries had strong religious backgrounds. Especially in the case of India, we have diverse types of religions, and so the relation between women and religion has obviously played a very crucial role in colonialism, in post-colonialism. The interactions between among colonialism, gender, and religion constitute some of the most significant and contradictory forces influencing our world today. Although some scholars have addressed race, gender, and sexuality in the colonial context, and others the post-colonial Bible, few have seriously engaged all the members of this critical trilogy. We have the examples of Uma Bharati and Sadhvi Ritambara, who have actually invoked fears of Muslim violence and thereby mobilized Hindu nationalism. In other words, women are objects as well as subjects of fundamentalist discourses. So they are the targets as well as the speakers of its most virulent rhetoric. So there is a statement by Robin Morgan in the anthology Sisterhood is Global, which says that women seem so cross-culturally to be deeply opposed to nationalism. This once influential view stands challenged by the nature of women's movements in large parts of the once colonized world. It means that it is different. Though Robin Morgan says that women did not like nationalism, they were opposed to nationalism, this was not the case in the case of once colonized countries. Women had to actually struggle against male opposition for equal participation in the process of democracy and also in the process of anti-colonial struggles. Later in the text, the author talks about West Bank, Namibia, South Africa, and how the nationalist struggles over there happened, and how it continued for a long period. So in Namibia, the constitution forbids sex discrimination and authorizes affirmative action for women, whereas in India, the constitution explicitly excludes women from the affirmative action programs designed for the so-called backward caste and upholds customary law in relation to the family. So she just wants to bring out the difference between a post-colonial country like South Africa and India. And in a country like US, the Equal Rights Amendment has not yet been ratified. Women's movements have often been closely aligned with working class struggles. So there the women's movements are connected only with working class. Later, Anya Lumba talks about the division, the differences between the First World and the Third World women, and also between white women and black women. If black women within the United States have questioned the politics of white feminism in that country, then the independent feminists in India have made valuable contributions in raising issues of sexuality and violence that were downplayed by nationalist and left-wing women's groups. So the feminists in India brought out the issues that were ignored by the left-wing women's group in India. So while concluding the essay, Anya Lumba mentions that the post-colonial women's aim was to show the fact that women's activism in the post-colonial world is not just inspired by the Western counterparts. It had indigenous in roots and other causes. As a result, there have been processes of rewriting indigenous histories, appropriating pre-colonial symbols and mythologies, and amplifying the voices of women. Thinks that colonialism has actually eroded certain women-friendly traditions, and it will be a good thing to bring back some of these women-friendly aspects of the pre-colonial past. So you all know that colonialism has tried to wipe the past history of the native people, and Anya Lumba thinks that this in some sense is bad because there were some practices which were good for the people, for the women. In the essay, she talks about how women are treated as guinea pigs for fertility and other medical experiments, and the recipients of drugs and contraceptives banned in the West. We have had many discussions related to this in the media, because when medicine is banned in the United States, it is sometimes used in the third world countries, especially in the case of women. He brings this point to our attention to show that globalization is actually somewhat like colonialism. It has the effects of colonialism, and in this globalized world, women's labor is actually universally expropriated, either directly or indirectly, especially to feed the colonial machine, to benefit the needs of the colonial people. And this is exactly what happens in the case of globalization also. In the globalized world also, women's labor, and especially third world women's labor, is used for the benefit of the first world people.